Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, interest rates. We'll do the usual look at the numbers, and then from there, I will do a little bit more to get you ready. We have a surprise quiz on Wednesday, and it will focus in almost entirely on time value of money. And if you've got those spreadsheets, that spreadsheet down, which gives you all the different problems, lump sum, annuity, perpetuity, all that kind of stuff. If you've got those down, you can do very well on this quiz. And that means that you will be able to hit the midterm exam and clean out the hard numbers problems in a matter of probably 5 to 10 minutes in there too. So this quiz is more preparing you for the midterm exam. And then we'll have one last quiz before the midterm exam, which will be like a mini midterm for you, just to prep you up well for that midterm exam. But before we do any of that, I got the numbers. Now we are in, I want to make sure that I do understand this. The markets are not open this morning or today, but we can still look at other markets aside from the stock market. Many markets don't look at holidays or anything like that. They're not concerned with that. Like commodities markets or bond markets, some of the bond markets anyway. And of course, international markets don't have any interest in our holidays, but we can still look through and have a look at everything that's going on and in other parts of the world. And as you can see, the Nikkei is down. Asia is in a kind of a quiet mood. Hong Kong is up. It's doing okay today. Not spectacular, but Australia is down too. So we got kind of a mild day over. It's sort of a not much going on any either way. But we do have in Europe, it was started out as a bullish day. As you can see, looking for example at the CAC or the Euronext, you can see that there was a good surge upward early, and then it just kind of died out. The bulls kind of gave up their momentum and yielded to the bears. And that's not something that is unusual, of course, but have a day where the bulls get their information that's good, and then once that information is digested, then the bears can come in and find bad things to sell about. And as we can see across the board, CAC 40 up just a tiny bit. And London, however, it maintained itself through the day. It's not a spectacular day up, though. Like I said, when you see anything 0.25% or less, that's pretty much a flat day. That doesn't mean much at all. Now, this is looking at the Dow from yesterday, from Friday. And as you can see, it was not a spectacular day up at all. The Dow, it had broken through a historic 50,000, and then it retreated from that. And the S&P 500 had a good surge, and then it retreated on Friday. And so I think the NASDAQ actually ended up in negative territory. And so you're seeing that kind of odd thing across Europe and the United States and Great Britain, that there was a surge in the morning of bull activity, and then it just kind of fizzled out as the day went along. There is, just as a side note, there's a number of analysts are seeing something called rotation happening right now. Now, rotation is when you see a large number of investors rotating out of a certain type of stock and turning toward another type of stock. Right now, there's a noticeable rotation out of the big high-tech ginormous companies. Investors are quietly rotating out of those and moving back into lower beta, more general kinds of stocks that are not as sexy, not as spectacular. And that rotation is very noticeable. I hadn't even seen the numbers, really. And a couple of analysts were showing the numbers. Yeah, there is a movement out of the high beta, big, big companies, and kind of getting themselves toward smaller and more reliable companies with lower betas, consumer goods, of those kinds of things. So that's where we are right now in the cycle. Investors getting themselves into a more defensive posture for the time being. Now, the rotation will pick up speed if we think we know what's going to happen. The rotation will pick up speed and more investor funds will rotate out of the big high beta stocks, high tech, and move toward more stable stocks down lower on the food chain as far as betas go, as far as market caps go. Stay tuned for more of it. There's a lot of things. There are a lot of variables playing in here. So it may come out very differently from what we're expecting. Now, over in the commodities, right now, the commodities have just awakened and they're coming online. And you can see that, interestingly enough, the crude and the Brent, overall crude index and the Brent crude have backed away from that 65-70 marker. They've come back a little bit, which is good news. But how long that will last, we're just going to have to wait and see. What's going on now is that numbers are coming in that, yeah, supply is beginning to shrink somewhat, which should bring up the prices. But the thing that is noticeable is that demand is pulling back, especially for gasoline, although for other hydrocarbon products too. Demand is slack, and we're coming into the season when demand should be picking up steam, but right now it's low, it's down. And of course, when demand goes down, that means that we have prices will go down. So you've got the force up of supply becoming a little bit less abundant, pushing prices up, demand getting slack, so it pushes prices down. So there's almost like two countervailing forces holding oil prices in kind of an equilibrium, a band right now. What was I going to show you here? We're going to talk about interest rates today. Right now, you see an interest rate right there. That 10-year bond is what we call a benchmark. It's like a bond, it sort of tells the story of all bond in all interest rates. And we'll talk a lot about interest rates today. And there are many, many different kinds of interest rates, but they all tend to follow the pattern of the benchmark 10-year. That's sort of like the one, okay, that one is doing something. That means that other interest rates will probably do something very similar. And so we get into that kind of watch this 10-year. To see what it does. And right now, it has eased back a noticeable amount from where it had been. Now, it's still above 4%, and that's still of concern. It had gotten below 4% for a little while, then it bounced back. The two concerns right now are, of course, inflation. Inflation is still out there, notwithstanding the government's numbers that are saying it's all gone. We know those numbers are false because they reported inflation in housing last month was 0%, which was ridiculous. So we don't trust those numbers. However, we do have other numbers we do rely on, and they're saying that inflation is still a problem. It seems to still be holding on, which means that with inflation still holding on, inflation itself adds to interest rates, and it also, through the actions of the Federal Reserve to try to stop it, that will increase interest rates as well. So we're not going to see very low interest rates for a while yet, but at least they've come down somewhat. Now, here's the sector map. That was as of Friday. Now, you don't see any evidence here, much evidence anyway, of rotation. However, it is going to be happening on a very small level right at first, as it is now, but it will pick up steam, and we may expect that technology sector to begin to show flash red a little more than it has in the past. Let me take you over, just do an HPR holding period return problem. And in order to do that, what we might want to do is go over here, and you can pull up your spreadsheet to do this to make it easier for you. So we can look at a couple of holding period returns. Files, and you go to your spreadsheets. And the one that we'll use first here is the holding period return. And that'll make this calculation of holding period returns a lot nicer, easier to do. Now, let's go over and have a look at the numbers here and see what we can find. I want to show you a couple of oddballs. Here's one that I've been watching for like 2.5, 3 years. It started out, when I first started looking at it, it was about $2 a share. It's an ETF, and I think this is its trading, yeah, PSIL. This is an ETF. It is a cluster of small cap companies that are working with funding from the federal government to study the therapeutic use of psilocybin, in other words, magic mushrooms, in treating psychosis. And it was a joke at first, but now notice, like I said, I was looking at this when it was about $2 a share. And I wish now I had just thrown a couple of $100 into it, because it's now $15.93 a share. And it still has some promise, but where it's not even projecting, oh, darn it. Do I see a projection? They don't even have a projection for this one. I thought they had a projection for a year out. So can't really do much about this one as far as projecting its price goes. But it's just one of those that's out there. It's something that it may or may not go further than where it is now, but it has climbed a lot over the last couple of years from a nothing kind of laugh it off kind of ETF to one that is now being taken relatively seriously. So there you are. Net asset value is still very small at 19.85. NAV is sort of like capital. Now, let's go to something else. We had one which, let me do this one. General Motors, GM. GM is now trading. Now, this is a sort of like a market that's, during a holiday, there is back trading, like a pre-market, waiting for the market to open tomorrow. So the pre right now is at 81.09, and it's projected to be 94.62 in 1 year from now. So let's do that HPR thing on it. There we go. So now we can kind of look at it. Okay, the beginning price is the 81.08. Well, we'll do 81.09. 81.09. Now it's projected in exactly 1 year to be 94.62. And it has a dividend yield of 0.89%. That's pretty pathetic, but there you are. No. There we go. No. 0.089. Oh, no.
0.89%.
So the total holding period return for a one-year hold on this is 17.58%. Now that's nothing to sneeze at. That's a decent return, but look at the beta. This is a high-risk stock. General Motors is 1.37 on the beta. So yeah, it looks like it's going to be a good play for a one-year hold, but you are going to be taking some risk in that kind in that one. And just to get another one, just to get you comfortable with using this instead of the calculator, which is what I used for the first couple of weeks I was doing these. Let's look at a banking stock, and probably I'll look at BAC, Bank of America, BAC. Now, Bank of America is right now playing. We can get that stock for $52.60. And 1 year from now, it's projected to be at a price of $62.23. And it has a dividend of 2.09. And that's a whopping return. What's a beta? Well, okay. There again, here is a stock that's going to have a really nice one-year hold, projected to have a one-year holding period return of 20.40%. That's hella good. However, again, look at the beta. It's a high beta stock, 1.27. That's pretty normal. Higher risk, higher expected return. So yeah, it's living up to its beta. It has the possibility of earning you better than 20% for a one-year hold. You can't get that at putting your money into a savings account, but you are taking a great risk, 1.27. I'm just curious about one other thing here. Let me look at Citi real quick. I think that's Citigroup. Financial intermediary conglomerate. All kinds of stuff going on with that. Well, I'm waiting here. And did I lose my internet? Huh. Okay. I lost my internet. That's disappointing. Let me do this. Matter of fact, I'm frozen. Finance.yahoo.com. Let me go back to the original site and see if I can. Well, I am dead. I'm frozen out. The internet is canceling on me here a little bit. You see how to use HPR. You'll be able to use it on the quiz. You'll be able to use it on the midterm and final exam. So these spreadsheets I'm showing you, they will be fully accessible even within Respondus. So make sure that at the top of the quiz, they'll say download these sheets, and you just click on the little down arrow, and they'll open up in Respondus so that you can use them for questions in there. Anyway, I'm giving up on this. Why is everything just shot? Huh. Oh, well. I'm going to give up on that for right now. Let me come out of this. Wow. Okay, now the next sheet, I want to give you a little more experience with the that other one. We're going to pull up the present and future values spreadsheet. I just want you to be a little more comfortable with it. Good. Now remember that it's probably a good idea every time you're going to do a new problem in these spreadsheets, re-download it from Canvas. because that will make sure that you haven't put anything in there that messed up a formula, and it'll make it so that you are have no reason to be afraid of getting something. Okay, come on. Don't save. Okay, bring this one up. It will, now one thing I will do for you is on the quiz and on the midterm, I will give the problems in the sequence of what you're seeing in these worksheets. First, you'll see lump sum, present and future value problems, one of each. Then you will see an annuity present and an annuity future value. And then from there, you might see an annuity and something like that. But the and you'll see a loan problem. Now the loans are inside of the annuity present and future values. So that one will be the fifth one you see. And then there will be the holding period return problem, which is a separate spreadsheet. But I will make them so that they are in the order that they are presenting as the worksheets from the first and then second and third. So when we look at these problems, the first thing we do is we identify what it is as far as, is it an annuity or is it a lump sum? The key for this is that if it's a lump sum, I'm just going to give you an amount of money. Well, Tom is going to get $15,000 in 12 years. Okay, there's no other amount of money in there, so that's a lump sum. That would be the first worksheet. Now, what are we trying to find? An amount now or an amount in the future. So the first one I'll say is that Tom is going, in 10 years, Tom is going to get $12,000. If we discount the money at 7.25% compounded quarterly, what is, how much is that money worth now? And that's the key. Definitely this is a present value. We're asking about an amount of money we don't know now. And you just key in 5849.75. Now, I always, well, for most problems, I say to the nearest dollar. So in this case, you would put in 5850. I always ask to the nearest dollar. If you can do that, you've got the problem. And then I will go on to a problem. You just received a $25,000 inheritance. If you put that in the bank for 15 years in an account that pays 4.50% interest compounded weekly, how much will you have in 15 years? Notice how I'm just following the narrative, and as I see the numbers, I put them into the right place. In this case, the answer would be, you put in the backs, $49,086, because I will have you just round it to the nearest dollar. For now, I will not ask you a time to value problem. The next thing that I would do is I would give you a problem. You will receive $600 per week for the next 10 years. If you discount that cash flow at 4.89%, how much will you have? How much is that worth now? How much is that worth now? And there's how much it's worth. $246,678. Notice that, how much is that worth now? That now word is almost a dead giveaway, that it's a present value problem. Starting today. Now, if I say that, that's a dead giveaway that it's a future value of an annuity. Starting today, you will deposit in the bank $250 every other month for the next 8 years. If the account pays 5.25% APR, how much will that be worth one period after your last deposit? And that's $14,964. If you can get this down, I mean, even if they, each of them takes 30 seconds for you to do, which is about normal, those five problems will take you 2.5 minutes. Now, we're going to do a loan problem. You want to buy a $38,000 car. You can get a loan with an APR of 6.19% for 6 years. What will your payments be? They'll be $633.18. If I say, what's the effective yield on that loan? It's right there, 6.37%. It's right there for you. You don't have to use the formulas that are in the book. You don't need to use a financial calculator. All of these problems, which are the core problems of FIL 240, you can do in Excel. Just use it wisely. Never any number or anything in a cell that is not white. Leave those cells alone, the orange and the blue ones. As long as you can do that, you should have no problem whatsoever just acing these. I'll give you the statistic. It's interesting. Last semester, the correct rate on these number problems was 79%. That's an interesting number. As you can see, it is not hard to get them, just get them right. The main thing that I noticed was the lack of attendance of those who did not get the answers to those. If you're here in the class, you got it, you're fine. And so that should take some of the studying off you. At least some of the intensive studying. That's all there is to that. Now, I want you to do your attendance radar right now while I prep up for the lecture here. It should be in there now. Okay. On we go into the darkness. The topic of this lecture and Front Wednesdays is interest rates. Here's the first thing. There is no such thing as the interest rate. I'm sure you are aware that there are many interest rates. There's the interest rate on a car loan, the interest rate on a credit card. There's the interest rate on your student loan. There's the interest rate on a savings account. There is a proliferation of interest rates. What we know from, it's just a basic principle of physics, is that underneath a noise of lots of different things is something that is at the base of all of them. We see this in quantum mechanics. We know that there are this vast array of quantum mechanical particles, bosons, leptons, and all that. So we ask ourselves, what's underneath all of those that's changing and its configurations to create all of this? And that would be the quarks. However, that is not just in quantum mechanics. It's in our field too. There is something underneath all of them. And just like quarks are a model, we can't see quarks, but we know if we design from the standard model correctly, we know that they explain what's going on. They are there, we just can't see them yet. It was like DNA. For easily 40 years, we could not see a DNA molecule. We knew damn well that it was there, but we just couldn't see it. And this is the thing here, is that underneath all interest rates is this animal called the real interest rate. It is the pure opportunity cost of foregone consumption. Now, it's the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. Now, you see, sir, you ask to borrow a dollar from me, and I give it to you, and you say, I shall pay you back in a year. Okay, you're going to pay me what back in a year? A dollar. And I said, the hell you say, because I'm giving up this dollar for a year. I could buy myself something with this. And you say, well, that's cheating. No, you get back a dollar. And I say, you see, I gave up, I surrendered the pleasure and use of this dollar for a year. That's why I call an interest rate an opportunity cost of foregone consumption. I've given up my own consumption of it for your benefit. So I want something in return for that. What is at the base of that? Well, there's inflation. No, underneath that, never mind inflation. I'm talking about just my pure giving up the use of it. That is what we call the real interest rate. We understand its dynamics and we know what's moving it around very well. The truth of the matter is that interest rates are the rental rate of money. And a short-term interest rate is a short-term rental rate just for borrowing money. You're not buying the money, you're renting it. And the interest rate is that rental rate. It's just like we talk about wage rates. Madam, I'm going to hire you. I shall pay you a wage of $18, in your case, $12 an hour. $18. You see, I am not buying you, Lord knows. You'd be too much trouble. I am renting. Let me do this with, you know what I mean, though. I am renting. For God's sake, woman. I gotta get polish my lecture. I'm renting you. Well, that doesn't work any better. The hell with it. You know what I mean. Okay. What I'm doing here is I'm establishing in all of these are rates. They're not amounts of money that purchase something. They're not like I'm buying a car. That's an ownership. But rates are what you have to give it back at some point. You have to surrender it. Like a bank that's giving you a 3.99% interest rate in a savings account. It is renting your money from you and it must reward you for that. So that's a real interest rate. Now, I have to take a little bit of an aside here, which steps into a little perilous territory. This is a capitalist concept, pure and simple. There are other financial systems in the world, one quite prominent, that prohibit the use of interest rates. There, it is embedded in their religious culture. It's called Islamic finance, and it does not use interest rates at all. They're not there. As a matter of fact, 10 years ago, the then chairman asked if we should have actually a little, bring it in as a formal part of an FIL 240 course, Islamic finance. And there was a lot of protests saying, oh, they really do have interest rates. They're just hidden and all that. No, that's a simplistic concept. But in our culture, in our capitalist system, interest rates are there, and they are the fundamental rock bottom of all of what we consider the cost of capital, the cost of money. Okay, so the real interest rate. The first thing to bring up about this is that in the short run, a central bank is the primary driver of interest rates. There are other factors too that are driving it, like the opportunities that are available with borrowed money, and expectations and all that. But at the heart of it, if we have the Federal Reserve involved, here is the amount of money on the horizontal axis, and here is the real interest rate. There will be a demand for money, a demand for cash balances. Look something like that. And then there will be a supply of money. Now, you took a macroeconomics course here, and they showed you that the supply curve at any given moment in time is actually perfectly inelastic. In other words, there is just a certain amount of money in the economy at any given point in time. So, the intersection of the supply of money and the demand for money establishes a real interest rate. One. Now, the demand for money is kind of odd. It's normally fairly stable. It doesn't move around a lot. It can flatten, it can move out or move in, but for the most part, the demand for money kind of stays put in the very short run. So if the Federal Reserve wanted to lower all interest rates, it would aim at lowering this guy right here. So what it could do is print more money, and that would shift the supply curve outward, which would bring us down, the interest rate down to there. So why didn't the Fed just print all the money in the world? There's a problem with that, unfortunately. In the longer run, too much money in an economy creates inflation. Inflation is not caused by increasing the minimum wage. Inflation is not caused by a company or two raising its prices. That's not inflation. Inflation is a pervasive, entire part economy thing. You can't cause inflation by simply raising the wage rate, the minimum wage. You can't cause inflation by having companies raise the price of their products. That's not inflation in the sense of an aggregate price level increase. The only thing that can create inflation is when you create more money than the economy needs. And so each dollar becomes worth less, which is inflation. But if the economy is really rolling along, yeah, you could probably increase the supply of money because there is more need for liquidity. So if the economy is rolling, you do want to grow the money supply, but you always want to move it at the same rate as the real growth rate of the economy. That's what the Federal Reserve is supposed to do. It shouldn't juice the economy when it's sad or contract the economy when it's too exuberant. It should just keep moving the money supply outward, tracking the real growth rate of the economy. as the economy needs more money to stay moving, you increase the money supply. If the economy doesn't need as much money to keep moving, you move back the money supply. But this is principally the driver of interest rates at the real level. Unfortunately, just like quarks, we can't see the actual real interest rate. We've got some statistical ways that we can kind of calculate it pretty well, but it's just not sitting there looking at us. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to bring in the term nominal. A nominal rate, an interest rate that includes an expected inflation premium. A real rate plus an expected inflation premium is called a nominal rate. So, if we put an IP on here, that's a nominal rate. Now, I caution something. The book doesn't emphasize this nearly enough. Inflation is not the issue. It's what we hear about, the consumer price index, the producer price index, but the inflation is not really what matters. It's expected inflation. And inflation is a fever. The expected inflation rate is the virus underneath it, the one that is hard to stop once it catches fire. Because if there's an inflation, the Fed could cut the money supply. That will bring up to simply drain out that overhang of liquidity. But unfortunately, the expected inflation rate could stay high for a couple of years, in fact, because people don't believe that the Fed is clawing back the liquidity. I'll try it like this. Madam, you are my employee. I hired you, and I'm paying you a really good wage, $100 a week. I'm a giver. $100 a week. Well, after a year, you come in for your first annual review, and I say, well, you're doing a darn fine job, darn fine. Okay, I see that inflation is 2%, was 2% last year, so I'm going to raise you to $102. I'll get back to work. Okay. Next year, you come in for your annual review. You're still doing great. Inflation, I see, last year was 4%. So I'm going to give you 4% increase. I'll get back to work. Now, the third year, you come in and I say, you're doing great. So I see inflation was 6%. So I'm going to give you 6%. And you say, stop right there, fat boy. What? You're rewarding me for what already happened. I've already lost 6%. And if you look at this, 2, 4, 6, I need 8% next year because I expect inflation to be that much. That's exactly how banks work. They don't care what inflation has been. They'll charge you an interest rate that tags what they expect inflation to erode of the balance over the next year, next 10 years, whatever. So that's why inflation isn't really the issue. It's that cancer of expected inflation. That's what's going on now. The Fed has pulled back the money supply, but we're still seeing inflation. What's going on? Oh, it's because everyone expects inflation to keep getting worse. And so we keep jacking our prices up. In my business, in mine, I am going into the art show season for next year. I've already repriced everything that I'm going to sell on Amazon, at shows, through other networks, e-commerce solutions, because I expect it to be there. Well, the Fed's already cut back their money supply. Let's all stop raising our prices. No one's going to do that until we really see through the long term that expected inflation has cooled down, that real inflation is not the problem that it was. Here's what we do. We have something called the risk-free rate. That is R sub real plus the expected inflation premium. And I'm going to use the IP that the book does, even though make sure you understand that that is expected inflation premium. It's the extra juice for the erosion of the purchasing power of the money. And that is a nominal rate. And that is the first rate. We can't see it directly, but we can get a good estimate of it. The risk-free rate, the best measure we can have of the risk-free rate is the yield on a very short-term treasury bill, government treasury bill. That's the best that we can do as far as seeing that one. That is close to the risk-free rate. In other words, if a security that was paying the risk-free rate would have a beta of zero, no risk. Now, it might still be volatile, but it has no correlation with the market. I'll show you where we can see this. Let me do this. God, that's an ugly picture. Reminds me of my uncle and his family. Okay. Let's get this up here. I should have had this before now. I can't bookmark sites very well on this, so I'll do it this way. I'll go over here. There's a site, a government site. Treasury yields. Treasury yield curve, we'll just do it that way. And this daily treasury rates, this keeps track day to day of the treasury bills. Now, if you look here, this would, oh, will you quit that? Par yield. I think I'd like to do it that way. They've gotten this looking real. Okay, here's a good one. Now, the one that we usually like to look at is a one-year T-bill yield. That is very close to the risk-free rate. Risk-free rate is a theoretical thing, just like the real rate is. So we have to find things that are very close proxies of it. In other words, approximations of it. Now let me take you back here, and what I'll do is, oh, I hate this. This is awful. They've changed the site. Oh, for heaven's sakes. Okay, let's take it back to 2024. Now, at the beginning of the year, you notice that the treasury yield was actually kind of flopping around here. I want to see the whole thing. Is there any way I could, where? Oh, I could get 100 of them. Oh, for heaven's sakes, this is terrible. I'm almost wondering if I could render an XML of it or an XML feed. Oh, this is a little, they've done so many things to make it more difficult. But if we look in 2024, we can see that interest rates were fairly stable. Look at that. I can't even go down beyond that. 2026. Oh, good. Thank goodness. I was going to say, wait, I've got that highlighted. Apply it. Let's try it again. There we go. Show. Okay. This is stupid. They used to have them all in a single column, but let me show you. Okay, here we go. 1 year. Do you see how these interest rates were actually higher than what I showed you recently? But notice how they were fairly stable at first. By the time we get to the end of 2024, we can see that the 1 year was still kind of slipping downward because the Fed had been trying to crush the money supply. But then once inflation began to show that it was easing up, we backed off somewhat. The Fed started to allow that supply curve to shift back out, which lowered the real rate, which lowered the risk-free rate. Now, by the time we get to the, is this the end? Yeah, that's the end of 2000. Now, let's get to 2025 and have a look. 2025. Here we see that the Fed is still holding a fairly stable risk-free rate, and that's at the end of the year. So now let's go to the current year, 2026. Apply it. And we can see that the rate had actually fallen dramatically in the early months of 2025. But it was beginning to come back up. By the time we get to here, the 1 year has crept up a little bit. And that's just because the Fed, it's holding the line. The current president wants interest rates to go down. He was threatening to fire the former chairman of the Federal Reserve because the Fed chairman would not lower interest rates because of the risk of reigniting inflation. But there's a new chairman who is coming on board, and the new chairman has shown the willingness to lower interest rates somewhat. And so that will juice the economy. Lower interest rates stimulate investment. They stimulate borrowing for cars, for factories, and all that. At the same time, that is at the risk of reigniting inflation. Let me take you on. So the core that is underneath every interest rate is this risk-free rate. That's the rock underneath. No interest rate would be below that because you are getting no risk at that interest rate. There couldn't be any rate that would want to be below that because it wouldn't reward people enough to take no risk. So here, this is a generic interest rate. It has two big chunks. The first one is the risk-free rate. Now remember that that rate is driven by the real rate plus the expected inflation premium. And then there is this risk premium. This is where individual debts, debt instruments, show their stuff because it has three pieces. The default premium, the maturity premium, and the liquidity premium. Sometimes you'll hear that one called the illiquidity premium. These three parts are moving. For example, a very safe loan would have a low default premium. Default premium is the extra juice in the interest rate in case you don't pay. The maturity premium, this is higher the longer the loan is, simply because there is more risk of interest rates moving around the longer the loan is, so there has to be some juice in there to take account of the unpredictability of the interest rates way down the road. So if I get a one-year loan, I mean, interest rates aren't going to move much in a year. But if I get a 30-year loan, interest rates could be all anywhere in 30 years. So there has to be some extra scratch in there for taking that, for a bank taking that risk. And then this one, the liquidity premium, or the illiquidity premium, as it's sometimes called. Here's the thing. When you take out loans, very likely the bank is going to dump that loan within days, if not hours. If they can't get rid of that loan, they will charge you more because they have to hold it to take care of it themselves. Let me tell you about this. You go into a bank to get a mortgage loan. What's going to happen is that the bank will make the loan to you, and they will have made other loans that day, home loans. They will bundle them together and they will sell them to what is called a secondary mortgage market. It is this vast, ginormous ocean of loans that are sucked into this, think of it like a sphere. They're all crunched together. They might be broken into different parts, you know, the principal payments, the interest payments, early payments, but it's a giant wad, billions and billions of dollars. And then those ginormous super loans are bought by the massive investors of the earth. China, Saudi Arabia, Canada, Europe, they buy those giant loans up. Giant trust funds buy them. They buy these giant spheres that are inside of them, all of these little tiny loans that were made by the millions in banks in the United States and in other countries. This is the secondary mortgage market. They are highly liquid. The banks know they can get rid of them. They do it every day. They just dump them out. So there's nothing about those. The bank doesn't keep them. You know, I pay my payment to the bank. No, you don't. They provide the service of taking the payments, which they keep a little bit for themselves, and then they send it up, the payments, to Ginny Mae, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. There used to be one for student loans called Sallie Mae. And that's where your loan is. The bank is just sort of like a caretaker to make sure you get the payments are made and to take the payments in. Those are easy to dump by a bank. Now, car loans, used car loans. Well, the bank is kind of on the hook for those because that's not an easy, I shouldn't say that. Someone told me that there actually is a secondary market for those. But most likely the bank is going to keep that. It doesn't want to. The bank isn't in the business of keeping loans. It's in the business of making loans and then servicing the loans. So they want to get rid of them. If they can't, there's an extra liquidity premium, a few percentage, a little bit of percentage on them. That's all there is to it. Now, a term that I'm going to use here is basis points. A basis point is 1/100th of a percent. So if you saw those numbers that I was showing there, the last week, the 10-year bond was yielding 4.24%. So what you saw there a little while ago, it's now yielding 4.05%. So it has dropped by 19 basis points. That's a term we use for fractions of a whole percentage. But anyway, the default premium might be anywhere from a few basis points on up to hundreds of basis points. The maturity premium just gathers steam over time. The 1-year loan might have, a 2-year loan might have 10 basis points over a 1-year loan. A 10-year loan might have 50 basis points over a 1-year loan. A 30-year loan might have 120 basis points over a 1-year loan. The maturity premium gathers steam as time goes on. The default premium It's just based upon how good your credit score is. Well, it's more than that. I shouldn't say that. But the liquidity premium, simply how likely is it that the bank can easily get rid of that loan? Remember the definition of liquidity, the efficiency with which an asset, the loan, can be converted to another asset. In this case, some kind of payment to the bank in exchange for the loan. But those are the three pieces of it, and then there's that piece right there. And together, these create an interest rate. So, a home loan. The first thing is that it would always carry, let's say, 3.54%. That's a risk-free rate right now. Now, over here, the default premium. On a home loan, let me try this. On a home loan, would you say that the default premium is high or low on a typical 30-year loan, home loan? Actually, believe it or not, it's low, because if you default on the loan, the bank gets your house. In other words, it's a collateralized loan. And that means that the bank will, even if you default, it'll get your home back. Just like a car loan. If you default on your car loan, the bank will get the car back. So it won't lose as much as it would lose if you stop paying on your credit card. If you stop paying on your credit card, I mean, the bank, there's hardly anything the bank can do to you except write you mean letters to you. So that's why credit card interest rates are super high, is because they have huge default premium, because there's nothing that they can get back if you stop paying. At least not, it'll cost them a lot. So that would be that default premium there might be, oh, let's say, 40 basis points. The maturity premium would be large on a 30-year loan, because over 30 years, there's a lot of volatility in interest rates. So that might be, let's say, 200 basis points. And the liquidity premium would be virtually zero, because the secondary mortgage market will just take it right away. So the total of that would be 3.94, 4.94, 5.94, and that would form the interest rate that they would tell you that they would lend the money to you at. Those moving parts, each customized to what it is. Is it a home loan, a car loan, a student loan, a credit card loan, a second loan on a house? They all affect those three pieces in their own way, and that's why you see all the different interest rates that are out there, is that right there. The moving parts change their orientations, and then an interest rate is set. If the Federal Reserve steps in, then you can see that R sub F move up or down based upon how they move the money supply. The other thing that might move it is the expected inflation premium. Right now, we have a pretty hard expected inflation premium. It's embedded, and it will take the Fed a long time to convince everyone, especially the banks, that they have finally stopped inflation. They've cut the money supply. They're going to grow it at the right rate from now on. Once the Fed loses its confidence, it loses the economy's confidence, it takes it a while to get it back. And that's why the Fed has consistently been holding the money supply in check for the last couple of years, possibly 2 years, maybe a little longer than that, was because before that, the Fed had printed a lot of money. Starting in 2019, there was pressure from the White House to juice the economy going into the election of 2020. The Fed did push money into the economy to try to boost it. But then the worst part was the lockdown, because the Fed had to borrow a lot of money to get through it. All the checks to people for their rent, the loans to zero interest loans to businesses that couldn't open their doors. And so the Fed printed a lot of money, and that caused inflation to flare up. By about 2023, the Fed was cutting it back again, trying to claw the liquidity back in. The problem was expected inflation, that the economy did not believe that the Fed was going to claw back all that liquidity overhang. And so we're still to this day, we're fighting expected inflation from the 2019-2020 push of money into the economy, and then later the 2022-2023 push of money into the economy. Those created an expectation of inflation that's still embedded in the risk-free rate. It should come out over the next 6 months or so, we hope, unless the Fed yields to pressure, political pressure, and starts printing money again. And then we won't get rid of the inflation. We'll just reignite it. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.